From Given, this is Purposing, the podcast that lifts the lid on how to run a truly purpose-driven business. I'm Becky Willen, and with the help of leaders at some of the world's most recognized brands, I'll be demystifying this often misunderstood topic into clear, actionable advice you can use in your own business. This week, I'm joined by Stanley Agnete, Green Financing Lead at WWF Netherlands. Stanley is helping to redefine how conservation is funded, shifting from traditional philanthropy to innovative financial models that bring in private capital and build long-term financial resilience. In this conversation, you'll hear why WWF is evolving its funding strategy in response to shrinking public and philanthropic finance, how impact investing brings discipline and scale to conservation, and what NGOs need to unlock investment-ready solutions. But before all that, let's explore Stanley's journey and how his childhood inspired his unique approach to finance and development. Growing up in Ghana, Stanley's worldview was shaped early on by service, community, and a powerful example set by his father.
Every day people talk about who their heroes are and who they look up to on a daily basis. I think my dad is one of those gentlemen that, you know, I can live a million years and I would not want to trade that man for anything. And he was subconsciously the individual who got my interest in sustainability. In the late 80s, HIV became a big problem in South Africa. And my dad was a doctor back in Ghana. You know, as a Black African, he felt the need to travel to South Africa, given the lack of Black doctors because of apartheid, to actually help.
They settled in a remote village where Stanley's father built a small clinic from scratch. The experience planted an early seed that social good and economic value weren't necessarily at odds.
Although he was helping the community, he was actually generating a lot of financial value. And then it started jotting in my mind. It's like, how is it possible that you can be in the furthest reach of the place trying to help people, but yet you can make money out of it?
That idea stayed with him even as he followed a more traditional career journey, studying economics and then landing a job in finance.
And I got my first job at an investment bank in South Africa. They taught me how to develop financial product, how to structure financially. And during the financial crisis, I actually took a step back and I asked myself, how is it possible that we can develop all of these financial tools and financial structures for normal people, but we cannot actually do it for development?
Today, that questioning continues to guide Stanley's work, underpinned by a clear mission.
My modus operandi in this whole world is to ensure that everybody is given equitable opportunities to find their own path. So my whole life, my whole job has been literally investing in opportunity-driven entities in and across the African continent. Well, now with WWF is global, but yeah.
So Stanley, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you very, very much for having me. I'm looking forward to a great discussion today. So thanks for having me on the show.
Yeah, no, it's great to have you. And your role at WWF is really focused on helping the organization think differently about its global investment structure. And I guess most people will know WWF as a conservation charity. So why are you even thinking about your investments?
I think as we go along over the last couple of years, we realized that we need to start thinking differently about how we look at conservation and biodiversity. I think many at times we've realized that there is a lot of commercial activities on some of those ecosystems that we work in. And if you look at global ODA, it's starting to decrease. Global philanthropic capital is starting to decrease. So for philanthropical work and for work like the WWF does, we need to start thinking differently. And so that is what we're starting to do, is try to look for monetization and commercial activity opportunities on the conservation work that we do so we can bring the private sector into it. And in doing so, it enables the ease of take up by the private sector of the solutions. So my job really is to try and create mechanisms and ideologies to bring the private sector into the work that we do, rather than receive donations from the private sector. So it's a co-creation ideology.
Yeah. And I guess that's a response to, as you say, overseas development aid, ODA, which is usually from governments, that we've seen a huge reduction in that spend in recent years from governments right across the world. And I guess it's what you're saying, that private philanthropy activity is all also decreasing. And that's why the entire sector needs more innovative approaches to finding that funding, I guess. Is that that's the sort of the context for this?
Yeah, of course. Because before the advent of impact investing, it was either or. It was either traditional investments or philanthropy. But now with the advent of impact investing, philanthropical capital is flowing more towards impact investing, which is creating a little bit of a shortfall for philanthropical capital, which is where the work like CARE International, WWF, and all the big NGOs actually get their funding from. So with that decrease in that, and the move towards impact investing by most of these philanthropical capital holders, we thought that it was time to also literally follow the market and be in line with where the market is evolving to.
And so that's a really helpful distinction, I think, between impact finance and philanthropical capital, as you called it. How would you make the distinction between those two ideas?
Well, one of the most important things about business is the accountability of processes and initiatives. I think what impact finance does is that impact finance targets social and environmental concerns. But on top of that, there's that accountability of I'm giving you an investment and I expect an investment return. So that means that within your process, there's going to be a little bit more discipline and accountability. This is not the whole philanthropical sector, but you know, most of the challenges that we have in the philanthropical sector is the lack of accountability and the lack of follow through in order to scale. Impact investing provides capital to organizations in order to invest in processes and procedures that align to the SDG or does not negatively impact the environment. So that investment should yield some form of return. And that is one of the major distinctions where philanthropic capital is looking at giving donations and grant towards solving a problem. And impact investing is giving investment towards solving the same problem. So giving two choices, most people go into the investment side of things because there seem to be much more of an ongoing concern element about that side of work.
That's fascinating. And I can see how that represents a huge shift for most not-for-profit organizations that have traditionally relied on donations and are now expected to be able to operate with more accountability and more commerciality. In your experience, what are the big differences in mindset that not-for-profits need to be thinking about? And how hard is it for those kinds of organizations to shift from a kind of donation model to an impact investment model?
Yeah, sometimes it's very, very, and we've got to also give credit where credit is due. We think the not-for-profit sector has held up the cause all this time. So we're not saying that, you know, there's any negativity about them at all. It's just the difficulty in the continuous funding of the work that is done in the not-for-profit sector. I think not every not-for-profit activity uses itself to some form of income. I mean, we all know, like, not everything is commercial. I think not-for-profits, I've got to start thinking more strategically by looking at their underlying activities and actually try to discern which ones yield itself to commerciality. I'll give you an example, if that is okay. For example, we at the WWF, we work in a lot of landscapes. And within that landscape, there's a lot of smallholder farmers that are actually involved in commercial activities. What we would normally do is that we teach them how to prevent deforestation, how to conserve biodiversity, and then walk away. Once we walk away, the unfortunate thing is that how is it carried on? Now, what we're looking at doing is that, listen, rather than paying all this money to teach them all of these things, why don't we partner with investment institutions, bring them in order to invest in the businesses itself, in order to change the processes and procedures that enable continuous prevention of what we're trying to achieve.
I think that example is a really helpful one. And I guess just to dig into it a little deeper. So if we're taking that example of working with smallholder farmers to adopt, you know, approaches that protect biodiversity and protect nature, I guess what you're saying is that historically the approach would have been about training and engagement. What does having a impact finance approach enable you to do differently? Because I guess it goes beyond training. What are the solutions look like, and how are they different for the experience of one of these smallholder farmers that you're supporting?
Yeah, of course. And as we look at the traditional business world, I think one of the things that the financial institute, one of the major roles that the financial institutions play is actually to help businesses ensure that they're able to achieve their, if I can say, their milestones and their goals. Now, one of the things that happens is that the minute you start providing financial services to farmers, one of the things you see is that now they're able to access machinery. They are able to buy the tools and equipment that they need in order to actually increase their yield and also work efficiently and smartly. Now, once farmers actually start seeing the improvements, they actually go out of their way to ensure that they maintain the status quo, because nobody wants to go back to not being able to access insurance when, you know, something goes wrong. So I think the one thing that was missing from our playbook was the ability to ensure that these smallholder farmers maintained all the learnings that was given to them by providing them the capital to implement the learnings. Because sometimes that's also the challenge. You go and teach somebody what to do, but yet they don't have the financial capital to actually take it forward. When you introduce the commerciality into it, it enables them to actually implement the know-hows and then hope to actually improve it later. Now, with the financial institutions, you need to be disciplined. You need to ensure that you are able to actually achieve what you say you're going to achieve in your budget. And you don't necessarily need to be profitable in the instant, but you just need to ensure that you're able to achieve what you need to achieve. Now, for us as sustainability practitioners, that is all we want them to do, is to ensure that they keep the process of deforestation and conservation and biodiversity within the acceptable levels. This is something indirectly the financial institutions can monitor when we get out of the program indirectly.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And I guess thinking about it from the side of the financial institutions, how do you ensure that the terms on which capital is lent is equitable? Because I think if we look back in the past, then that hasn't always been the case. I think, you know, actually, especially in the space of agriculture, that there were inappropriate products being sold to smallholder farmers, whether that was about kind of, you know, increasing huge use of pesticides or on terms that just were not sustainable. So how does that come into play here?
I think one of the biggest misconception and misalignment is a topic that you just mentioned. And I think that in sustainability, we have to make a distinction between emerging markets and developed market. Now, I distinguish these two by calling sustainability in developing markets should be looked at within a developmental sustainability mindset. And sustainability in the developed world should be looked at as transitional sustainability. Because what is happening is that people are using transitional rules in the emerging market, which is causing the misalignment of pricing. Because if I'm looking at expectations from the first world and trying to apply to smallholder farmer somewhere in Congo, there's such a huge risk perception that there is going to be a massive difference in pricing. And that is one of the massive issues that we have in sustainability, is that we are actually combining it into one big bowl. But there has to be a distinction between developmental sustainability, which is what is happening in the developmental ecosystem. There's really any infrastructure. So we have to develop this infrastructure. So while we're developing this infrastructure, we're developing it with equitability and sustainability in mind. In the developed world, we have infrastructure. What we are doing is that we're transitioning this infrastructure into green infrastructure. That means that the income that the old infrastructure was in is still going to be there. So that means that you think, oh, okay, so there's cash flow, so I'm going to charge them less. But then I'm going to charge the participants in the emerging markets much, much more because they don't have the cash flow, because they don't have the infrastructure. And I think from the point that you just made is that if we start looking at them differently and start incorporating this mentality, this pricing exploitation will absolutely work itself out, because there are rules and regulations in Europe that enable non-exploitatory pricing and not exploitatory pricing of consumers, where in the developing world is hardly non-existent. So what happens then?
Well, let's dig into that, because I think that's fascinating. So how do we need to design financial instruments that work for developmental sustainability in that context? How do they need to be different in really practical terms?
There's two main things that we need to do that I think we're failing at this moment is the development of local capital markets. Because once local capital markets are developed, it's much, much cheaper to raise money locally than actually look for money internationally. So I think we also got to think about the most important is developing the financial ecosystem, firstly. And in developing the financial ecosystem is, unfortunately, I'm going to say this, but a lot of people are not going to like it, we need a little bit more leverage from international and more equity from local. Mm. What is happening right now is that the challenge we have, and you know, I've seen this with most of the developmental banks, is that we are using concessional capital in order to invest equity in some of the most critical sectors in developing countries, i.e. we're using equity to invest in energy, we're using equity to invest in agriculture, we're using equity in the financial institutions. That means that the locals do not have the ability to actually manage those three critical assets. So those are the kind of things that we need to be thinking about. Should we be investing equity in those areas, or should we be looking for local equity and then try and leverage this local equity that when the time comes and the asset is fully realized, debt holders can go out and the locals can hold onto that asset. And then the income from that asset is what you use for further development. Unfortunately, everything is being extrapolated as dividends or profits.
So we've spent a bit of time looking at what's needed if we're going to change investment mindsets and models and practices around developmental sustainability. But you are also working in the space of transitional sustainability. So what are some of the things that are really important to get right if we want to use finance as an instrument for progress when it comes to that transitional sustainability in more developed economies?
Yeah, I think, I mean, that's a very, very good question. And I think transitional sustainability is currently in this, is in a rich vein of form right now, because one of the biggest challenges that we had previously back in the early 2010s, when the whole idea of sustainable information investment was kicking off, was a lack of full portfolio activation. i.e. there was a lack of different financial instruments that will allow us to actually sell to retail customers, because that's where most of the money came from. You know, retail customers put their money in the institutions and the institutions then invest in it. And I think right now what is happening is that the advent of the European taxonomy, the SFDR and the policies that are coming out of the EU, and especially in the global north, is actually helping finance actually dictate how companies invest indirectly. Because now you cannot go to the bank and to request funding to go and invest in coal, for example. So the financial, for me, the financial institution is almost the linchpin between quick acceleration and transitional sustainability. Because right now, most of the operating companies that have got productions that are unsustainable can transition to new assets. So the innovation is there. But right now, they need the funding support in order to get to that innovation. And I think that's where the mismatch and the timing difference is, that the innovation is there, but the funding is yet to follow. But slowly but gently, the funding is following.
Yeah, yeah. It's really interesting that you talk about that, because one of the other people that we have on the show this series is former Emirati MPD. So one of the kind of, and his entire role is focused on unlocking more of that kind of sustainable finance, very much at the transitional end. So really focused on buildings, infrastructure, EV adoption, all of that kind of thing. So what do you think needs to happen in order to unlock more of that finance? So if we've got the solutions, the innovation is there, what needs to change in the system to enable the acceleration of these technologies, innovation?
I think that is, and that is one of the best points, is that most entrepreneurs right now that actually come up with this type of innovation believe that innovation itself is going to, if I can say, attract the relevant supporters into what they are thinking about. But at the end of the day, one of the things that we have to still remember is that an investment is an investment. You know, an investment requires the money to work for the investor and for the investor to come back. And I think the scaling issue that we're having in these areas is that the underlying companies that are actually coming up with these innovations to raise the funding, they don't have the business acumen in order to push it forward. What I always tell my social entrepreneurs who are mentors is that, listen, at the end of the day, 9 out of 10, whatever innovation that you're coming up with, an existing company might need that innovation as an extension of their business. So why don't you actually start talking to these companies, established companies, to see how you can create an innovation that actually fits their current way of operating in order to easily have that technology adopted within an existing infrastructure. You are not going to compete with the big companies because they will price you out of the market. The big companies are looking for innovations in order that they can transition as well. So it makes good sense to actually, like, for example, somebody who comes up with a new way of nurturing renewable energy assets, the first people I'll go and speak to is the energy companies. Do you know what I mean? And so at the end of the day, speaking to the energy companies, I don't mean you're going to give your idea away. I mean, you've got to come up with a balance that enables you to actually realize your dream. And sometimes it's about giving up a little bit of equity in order to realize your dream. So the challenge that we have is that everybody thinks their innovation is going to take off with that in a partnership. But their balance sheets are actually not strong enough in order to entice these financial institutions to come to the party. Who are the potential adopters of this technology that I could actually work with in order to scale it to the max that needs to be? So I think that is the biggest challenge. There's the lack of balance sheet and the lack of business acumen to allow the free flowing capital. And that's why pension funds and insurance companies are finding it very, very difficult to get in the sector because of the balance sheet and, of course, the inability to scale and scale fast.
Yeah. So it strikes me that there is a redrawing of the relationship between these different actors that needs to happen so that you have, I guess, those more established corporates that pension funds can invest in, partnering or working much more closely with startups and innovators who have got the vision and potentially the technology. And then somebody needs to sort of help new partnerships, new forms of collaboration emerge that make this possible.
Unilever does this very, very well. And that is what has made Unilever one of the most sustainable companies in the world. It's not because they internally sat down and say, hey, let's change all the processes. They looked out into the market, looked at their businesses, looked at their business model. They looked at innovations within sustainability that can help them align themselves, and they just worked with them or bought them over. So I think this type of relationship could also help develop the scaling that we need within the sector.
And so I guess, yeah, what's your advice for leaders in corporates who have quite big ambitions when it comes to sustainability, but perhaps lack the agility, entrepreneurialism, and potentially even the technology as it stands? What would your advice to them be about partnering, supporting entrepreneurs to unlock the sort of opportunities that Unilever have been able to?
I think as a leader of any organization, you have got a fiduciary duty to your shareholders to ensure that you are able to actually maintain their long-term shareholder wealth. Now, as given what is happening right now, we are at an impasse where we need to start innovating sustainably in order to ensure that we are within the relevant 2%. Now we're within the 2%. So for a leader within a certain segment, you really got to not have your ear on the ground, but you really got to understand the type of innovations that are coming through your sector that could be very, very useful to your company's processes and procedures. One of the things that we keep reminding leaders is that, listen, you want to be in front of the curve before regulations come in. Now, at the end of the day, the one way to be in front of the curve is to have your ear on the ground, especially most companies have innovation centers. Those innovation centers should really not just be looking at product innovation in terms of our internal product innovation, but what other sustainable innovations are coming out there that are around our products or companies' sphere of influence that we can actually bring on board to co-design to grow. We do understand some of the biggest challenges that leaders have is that sometimes innovating internally, if you get it wrong, can be very costly. So unfortunately, at this stage, we got to also look externally for those innovations to bring them on board. And so that is one of my biggest advice to leaders is that there are a lot of innovations out there. Chase them down.
So let's cover the ESG question, because I think in the world of financial institutions, sustainable development, the idea of ESG has really dominated much of the narrative over the last decade, but more recently come under increasing scrutiny for a whole variety of different reasons. Now, you've been a critic of ESG as an investment tool. So what do you think proponents of ESG have got wrong?
I think, firstly, one of the things that we need to understand is the subjectivity of individuals. Now, if we look at impact and if we look at sustainability, there's a lot of subjectivity within sustainability where what you find important may not be what I find important. So if I find water more important and you find agriculture more important, how do we actually value, how do we create equalization and those type of mindset? If we look at traditional accountant, it's just one number, it's profits. So for me, I think ESG is a very, very, it's a construed construction in order to create standardization. And until there is one acceptable rule on what is acceptable and what is not, ESG is all about greenwashing. And because of the mere fact that how somebody measures one thing could be the same thing. Somebody could measure it differently and input that in their sustainability reporting. And you as the reader is kind of thinking I'm matching apples with apples. But the process in which you got to that answer is completely false or different. Funny enough, my MBA paper was on social assessment. And the conclusion was that it is very, very difficult to measure social return. It was just not done. And one of the lessons I learned during my MBA was that value is only created once you have an acceptable seller and an agreeable buyer. Now, if we talk about looking at sustainable value, I think at this stage in time, unless we have an efforts, I think sustainable value is going to be individualistic between the investor and the investee. It is very, very difficult to compare across the different sectors. So if you are looking at ESG, I'm looking at ESG in one sector. Rather than looking at ESG in one sector and comparing it to the other sector. I mean, there's elements that you can do it, but I do feel that there's a lot of falsehoods. And this falsehoods is really, really forcing a lot of negativity and leakages out of the system.
Yeah, yeah. And so I guess, because this might be an oversimplification, but I suppose when faced with that challenge, which I think a lot of people would recognize, it feels like there are different routes you can take. You can really lean into the search for standardization. You can, I guess, really, you can accept that actually this is subjective and maybe we need to treat sustainability, stop trying to treat it like a financial asset and treat it like less tangible assets like you know, innovation. It's, I think people would also agree, it's pretty hard to measure innovation in a kind of as a single concept. Or I guess there's something in the middle, which is you get more specific. So you only look at, you know, you take a sector by sector approach, for example. Do you have a view on which of those routes sort of makes most sense?
One of the challenges that we have with ESG and why it becomes so critical is that for companies to actually show value, it's got to come through the balance sheet somehow.
Yeah.
So it's about asset appreciation. So, I mean, if you look at it, we started reporting ESG in the, if I can say, sustainability reports, which are non-audited. So anybody can put anything in there. I do believe that, listen, at the end of the day, measuring sustainability is very, very important. And the way I truly see it is that we have got to move away from standardization for now. I'm not saying forever, for now, and move into categorization. Now, if we have a sector-based ESG measures for each sector, which is internationally agreed upon, it makes it easier to compare apples with apples then. And I think that's what we need to start. Rather than go standardization across the whole ball chain, let's start with standardization within the agricultural sector. Let's start with standardization within the water sector. And then once you, over time, as we actually better understand the parameters, you can actually bring standardization to those different elements. But we got to, rather than for, especially for sustainability, because of the subjectivity of individualistic and value propositions, we got to look at categorization and then later on move on to standardization. And I think that will be steps. Ladies and gentlemen, let's not forget what got us into trouble with the financial financial sector back in the 2006s and 2007 was all about mismeasuring and representing assets. We don't want to do that here again. And, you know, I know that within the sustainability sector, we have companies like B Corp and those ones that are doing ratings and stuff. And I keep saying that let's be very, 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 very careful, because anything that is not legal, regulated or law, it is always due to subjectivity. And that is where my biggest concern in ESG really is. I think as a measure for looking at a sector-wide issue, yes. But as a measure for looking at a market-wide issue, no.
So I guess if we were to fast forward 5 years' time, and a lot of the actions that you've described when it comes to investing in developmental sustainability have been taken, like, what's different? What can getting this right unlock for people, but also for society?
I think once we get this right, we will not be talking about sustainable investment or sustainability anymore, because it will be baked into our system. Once this type of ideologies are baked into our system for humanity, I mean, I think one of the biggest concerns for us is the ability to actually remain a living organism on this earth. People forget, when we talk about the keeping it within the 2 degrees, we're not talking about the fact that, like, you know, the earth is going to disappear. We're talking about the fact that humans will not be here. And so if you talk about humanity, firstly, it provides us the ability to continue living, but yet it also provides us the ability to continue enjoying our ecosystem for a long time. I mean, you know, once the climate is protected, our jobs are indirectly protected, our environment are indirectly protected. And if I can say, one of the biggest issues that people fail to see sometimes is that if you look at refugee crisis and all of those things, it's a function of shifting ecological systems across the world because of the massive impact that we're putting on it. So when we talk about humanity, I think this will serve humanity from the bottom up. I mean, basically, when we talk about companies, we always talk about transitioning risk and, you know, and for companies, at the end of the day, without the ability to actually produce, you are no more relevant, really. Yes, I'm not talking about technical terms. I'm just talking about just the simple mindset of, like, what happens if we don't get it right. And for humanity and businesses, it's equally as devastating. So I think it's for us to get it right. And hopefully, when you ask the question, how do you see this in 5 years? I hope in 5 years, we're not talking about sustainability and the distinction, because it is part of our everyday life.
Stanley, thank you for being such a brilliant guest on Purposing.
Thank you for having me on there. It is always a pleasure to have the opportunity to discuss sustainability because, as we all believe, without the need to actually transition, if we breach that 2% global warming, we are in big trouble. So I do believe that it's upon all of us to try and share the message to ensure that we are all aware of what is going on. So thank you for having me again.
Thanks again to Stanley. Loads of brilliant thinking there and such a wide-ranging conversation. So here are a few new ideas that I've taken from the conversation. Context is key. I hadn't heard the distinction between investing in transitional sustainability and developmental sustainability. But of course, I recognise the challenge of applying a one-size-fits-all solution or generalised principles, regardless of what's really needed. Understanding the context and co-creating solutions with the people who'll be using and affected by those solutions will always be a better approach. Most people agree that we have the transitional technology and solutions we need to move to a more sustainable future, and that it's finance that's really needed to achieve scale. But we also need the entrepreneurs behind those solutions to partner and collaborate more proactively with big corporates who need those solutions. I think that raises an interesting question about who might convene or broker these relationships, combined with access to capital, something that my colleague Astrid Doroyeva is currently working on. And finally, when it comes to ESG, if we want transparency, reporting and disclosure to drive progress, then we've got to stop obsessing with general standardization for now and start with categorization. This means the standardization of metrics within sectors so that we can properly and accurately evaluate those assets. Wow, we really did cover a lot of ground. I hope you've enjoyed this episode. If you'd like more insights and inspiration on purpose and the role of business in society, with brilliant insights from people like Stanley, download the Insider's Guide to Purpose at givenagency.com/thinking.